We're live. I'll go 5, 4. Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of June 25th, 2015. Today, we're pleased to be joined by our frequent guest, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing, D.R.?
Good, how you doing?
Good. Very well, very well. As always, a pleasure to have you here. So, DR, lots of stuff going on this week on all kinds of fronts. I think that one of the more interesting events that people ought to be aware of actually happened over in Europe. The background is that the country of the Netherlands, the country of Holland, is particularly vulnerable to climate change because they are below sea level. And if you remember the story of the little boy who stuck his thumb in the dike, he was such a hero to keep the land from flooding. And Holland has always been sort of a leader in green energy. They have wind turbines, and most of their energy comes from green sources. But this week, they did some broke some legal ground as well, right? So tell me,
Yes.
DR, what happened?
Yes, it's been a ruling that has been hailed worldwide, and the BBC noted that on June 24th, a Dutch court ordered the Dutch government to cut greenhouse gas emissions by at least 25% by 2020. It was a lawsuit filed by an environmental organization on behalf of almost 900 Dutch citizens, basically claiming that the Dutch government wasn't doing nearly enough to try to reduce greenhouse gas emissions to, help the world keep under 2 degrees Celsius. It's unclear as to whether or not the ruling will be appealed. It was from a district court. The BBC reports that the ruling was unprecedented in Europe and is definitely going to, if it's upheld, will definitely put pressure on the Dutch government to sort of ramp up dramatically its deployment of clean energy. The BBC and other stories note that, while they do have fair amounts of wind and solar, they're also fairly dependent on fracked natural gas. And obviously, this ruling, if it's upheld, will clearly signal that it's time for the Dutch government to go 100% fossil free, basically.
So that's great, but the Netherlands is basically a tiny contributor. I wouldn't say tiny, but a small contributor to global pollution, right? You would imagine they're probably less than the state of California. They're probably comparable to some states up here in New England in terms of the amount of greenhouse gases. So, and the goal that they were set of 25% by 2025, right?
By
I mean,
2020.
By 2020. Well, that's essentially the Massachusetts Global Warming Solutions Act target. So I guess the question is, why is this, and I have the answer, but why is this all by itself such an important ruling? I
It's
guess
an
who cares? In the Netherlands, there was a court case in the Netherlands.
It's important because there's also, my understanding, a legal action in Norway and also legal action in Belgium, attempting to sort of get the courts to do what politicians will not do, which is to take aggressive action to reduce carbon emissions. And it also has some degree of impact in the United States as well, because we've discussed previously the various lawsuits filed by an organization known as Our Children's Trust to try to get the courts to mandate reductions in greenhouse gas emissions.
And I
And
think
there.
that's the important point, DR, is that this is the first time, basically globally, that climate hawks have won in court, right? So this is a tort proceeding of
Yes.
damage to the people, and the court agreed that the government has to be forced to take action based on whatever, we talk about public trust doctrine and things like that. But the court is forcing the government to take action, and that's the precedent, right? That's why it's a big deal.
Exactly. And it also comes one day after a ruling on June the 23rd in a Washington state court in the United States, in which Judge Hollis Hill ordered the Washington State Department of Environmental Protection to consider the best available science before deciding what policies should be implemented to reduce carbon emissions. This was filed by a different group. It was not filed by Our Children's Trust. It was filed by the Western Environmental Law Center. And this has also been hailed as a potentially landmark ruling because, According to the NBC affiliate in Seattle, Washington, quote, the ruling may give Governor Jay Inslee an opportunity to take action after failing to pass his climate package with the state legislature. Jay Inslee was trying to pass some form of carbon pricing legislation, but it was consistently blocked by denialists in the state legislature. There was a segment in the documentary Years of Living Dangerously that discussed this, and the feeling is that if this ruling is upheld by higher courts, this will essentially compel the state legislature in Washington State to do what they have been previously reluctant to do.
And it's interesting because we've talked a lot about sort of legal issues on this show, myself not being anything near a lawyer, but it's an important precedent that now, you know, we've talked about something called a public trust, which is a responsibility of the government to protect the environment, and building these legal arguments. The one in Holland and in Europe, of course, has no binding impact on the United States. But if Norway does it and Belgium and these other places, it begins, I mean, countries look at each other and there is a back and forth influence as to what is considered legitimate law. And of course, here in the United States, for the first time, as you say, out in Washington State, again, in a court case, the court agreed that there were certain actions that had to be taken because of climate. Right? Mm-hmm. These are all good precedents. I mean, I think you were the one is that, DR, you said you keep losing until you start winning, and then you begin to win, right?
And to your point, it's interesting that we may start to see a worldwide legal consensus that this is how you combat rampant greenhouse gas emissions on the heels of the worldwide scientific consensus of what's causing the problem. I believe there was a report, a story in The Guardian earlier this week that made this point that, you know, when legislatures won't act and when leaders won't act, you have to turn to the courts. Mm-hmm. And that's occurred both in the United States and internationally. So it does seem that the courts may finally provide the relief that's long been needed.
Right. It's a recognition. It's the court's recognition, I think, sort of in the most general sense, is that the government has a legal, an inherent responsibility to do these things, right, to address the climate issue. Maybe they don't necessarily, the court's not going to talk about exactly how you do it, but there is an inherent responsibility aside from sort of the political machinations of any particular government. But the government has to protect the environment as the common good, which then goes back to what the Pope said, right? The planet's the common good. So there's all these sort of moral and legal things forming up that are all going in the right direction, huh?
And you do wonder, are we going to see rulings in which the Laudato Si, the encyclical, is referenced? Obviously not referenced in the legal context, but referenced as something that points to the merits of taking these actions.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's... Well, it's an interesting thing. I mean, so there you go. Over in Holland, they may be small, but they're making breakthrough, shall we say, the thin edge of the wedge, right? They've got Definitely. This legal case going, and they've won. So speaking of winning and losing, DR, you win some, you lose some. Tell me, what happened to our favorite three-letter acronym, the TPP, this past week?
Yes, well, there's a bit of a bad news and potentially good news, ironically enough. On June the 23rd, the United States Senate voted to provide President Obama fast-track authority for the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which will basically sort of, it was a 60-37 vote, which will basically, you know, help to move this odious trade deal to his desk.
By the thinnest possible margin, the Senate pass this, let this thing go through without a filibuster, right?
Exactly. And then from there, the House on June the 25th gave final approval, according to the New York Times, to what's known as trade assistance, essentially providing a help to workers who will be displaced by these trade deals. That was a vote of 286-138. Some of the 138 who voted against, who weren't, you know, thrilled with this, they basically made their voices heard on it. But in any event, it does seem to be heading to Obama's desk for approval. However,
well, just hang on, just to be clear. So the TPP is this. Just so that, again, everyone's on the same page. TPP is this trade pact. Environmentalists are upset about it because it gives a green light to corporations to sue the United States in extra legal courts over profits if we pass a carbon tax. So that's from an environmentalist perspective. But this particular law simply allows Obama, President Obama, to negotiate the treaty and present it for an up or down vote in the Senate. So it's not the treaty itself, it's permission to negotiate the treaty. Right?
That's correct. That's correct. Right. And the good news for climate hawks is that there was a report by Stephen Collison on CNN.com on June the 25th, in which he noted that even if President Obama signs the TPP, it still has to be ratified, and there's going to be an intense push by what Stephen Collison notes is a, quote, growing coalition of union, environmental, and community groups to heap pressure on lawmakers who will now face a vote of on ratifying it in the volatile political atmosphere in the 2016 election campaign. Stephen Collison goes on to note that, when it comes time to ratify this, there's going to be a lot of discussion within the context of the presidential campaign of previously controversial trade deals, many of which resulted in good jobs being outsourced to foreign countries, and also resulted in environmental standards and food standards being put in jeopardy. So the strategy by opponents of the TPP is to see if this can be dragged out, the ratification, if it can be dragged out to 2016, at which point there will be a lot of people very, very reluctant to ratify this trade deal.
Right. Well, there's that. That's right. The delay. We've seen various opponents of everything just trying to delay. So maybe that's what climate hawks should do. Yes, the TPP is unfortunate. My question is, DR, and this is: do you think that when this treaty, we finally get to see the currently secret details of this treaty? Do you think that Obama may have pulled out some of the more terrible aspects of it and turned back on it? And maybe he'll surprise us, or do you think he's all in and he's going to do what the corporations want him to?
I don't think there's any potential upside to this. I think it's simply a matter of a situation where his advisors have told them that this is a good deal, that the same advisors have told the various senators who voted for it that this is a good deal, that, you know, that this is, as Obama has claimed, you know, somehow the most progressive trade deal ever, regardless of whether or not that's reality. And it's sort of an example of the sort of, you know, beltway groupthink that gives rise to these sorts of odd trade deals. It's the same sort of beltway groupthink that gave rise to NAFTA. It's been pointed out how many times that Ross Perot was right when he talked about the giant sucking sound of American jobs, and yet he was ignored and ridiculed and mocked and laughed at until the beltway, you know, realized too late
that he
was absolutely right, and this is happening once again.
Yeah, the analysis I've seen says that that most of the actual trade tariffs have been dealt with, and that at this point, things like the TPP are mostly about intellectual property and the investor-state dispute council or system. I mean, these side issues that make it nice for the corporations to do business, they can make more money, but it's not fundamentally about breaking down tariffs. And most so, we've talked so much about the TPP. I think that we'll be back to it. I guess it's not clear when the actual treaty now is going to be presented. Right?
Yeah.
It's a few months off, kind of thing.
Exactly. And it's been pointed out also as well that a lot of the senators who voted for this, they're going to be on vacation in the next few weeks and potentially having town hall meetings, so people will be able to, you know, let their voices be heard.
Yes,
and they
yes.
can let their voices be heard now as to what they think about the decision to vote for this thing.
Well, okay, so there's the TPP. The other interesting thing that happened this week is that our favorite government agency, the Environmental Protection Agency, headed by our own Gina McCarthy, put out a fairly interesting report that tries to educate the public. And of course, it's kind of a technical report, but it's also a accessible sort of language. But basically, how much is going to cost to do nothing, the cost of doing nothing about climate change, right? And so they compare really two extreme cases. One where you essentially do nothing. You follow the business as usual path. You know, wind turbines are built occasionally, but mostly we keep burning fossil fuel, versus a more aggressive, basically, I suppose, the EPA's plan, and showed that there were huge billions in, it was $180 billion in medical care alone difference by the end of the century, right? Did you see that report, DR? I mean, what do you think of it?
Yes, it was a report that was released on June the 22nd, and according to the Associated Press, the report noted that, quote, failure to act on climate change could cause an estimated 57,000 deaths a year in the United States from poor air quality and cost billions of dollars a year in damage from rising sea levels, increased wildfires and drought, as well as higher costs for electricity to cool homes and businesses in hotter temperatures. It comes almost a year after the so-called risky business report issued by Henry Paulson and Tom Steyer and Michael Bloomberg, noting the economic costs of a business-as-usual policy. And it also came, it was also released a day, I believe, before a study by the British medical journal The Lancet, which noted how expensive in terms of the human toll a business as usual approach to energy worldwide will be. And it goes to and again it goes to show you that when people raise the issue of it will cost too much to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, you can immediately throw these reports back in the faces of people who say that and say, you know, what's the cost of not doing anything? What's the cost of inaction? You know, there was a writer named, I believe, J.J. Goldberg, who writes for the Jewish Daily Forward, who talked about how Dick Cheney would always run around saying that if there was a 1% chance of a terrorist attack, you should be mindful of that and respond. And J.J. Goldberg made the point that, well, there's a 97% chance of an attack from severe extreme weather events. Shouldn't you use that principle to do something about it?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's hard to get people, you know, it's like saving for your retirement. You know, it's like it's better to do it now than later. Humans have such a tough time with it. But I know that everyone listening to this show gets it, that it's much cheaper to take action now than it will be in the year 2050. And God bless you all. Go tell other people about it, huh?
Mm-hmm. So, it pays to take action.
Hmm?
It pays to take action.
It pays to take action. So, well, let's go back to another legal issue, DR, since we've got our rum pole of the Bailey wigs on here tonight.
Mm-hmm.
There was what could only be described as a blockbuster Supreme Court decision made actually today, right, where Obamacare, actually the Affordable Care Act, was protected, the tax subsidies, the whole Burwell versus King thing came down.
Mm-hmm.
What are the implications? Why on a climate podcast would we want to talk about the Obamacare Supreme Court ruling?
Well, there was a great post by Ann Carlson on the Legal Planet website discussing the issue of King versus Burwell, and Ann Carlson made the point that it's an interesting reversal from Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, who last year in a ruling known as Utility Air Regulatory Group versus EPA, basically said you have to pay attention to the full context of a statute. And this time around, King versus Burwell suggested that this full context of a statute doesn't matter, and this has implications because there are elements of the Clean Power Plan and elements of mercury rules and other anti-pollution rules that have language that may be considered ambiguous, and if it's interpreted a certain way, it can be used to kill the statute totally.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's interpreted within the context of the statute would be found constitutional. It's very, very interesting that the Supreme Court in a 6-3 ruling basically said that you had to look at the context of a statute and not just, you know, nitpick and cherry pick and overanalyze and hyperanalyze a specific ambiguously worded element of the statute.
Right. Just to be explicit, the Obamacare ruling, for anyone who's listened to the news, is about the fact that in the law it says these state marketplaces had to be established by the states. Or it was, you know, it basically said established by the states is the four words. And the people who were trying to kill Obamacare took that to say, well, you cannot have a federal subsidy, and therefore the whole thing is, you take a, if the federal subsidies can't be spent in all these crazy states that don't have their own marketplaces, that would kill Obamacare. So it was the interpretation of these four words taken pretty much out of context of this whole law. For the Clean Air Act, which is basically the president's clean power plan, there are two conflicting, almost contradictory statements about what the EPA can act on, and I think it's called, if my memory serves, it's line 111D, and we may hear that a lot more over the next year or so. You heard it here first, 111D, and somehow there are, the Senate passed one version and the House passed another version, and they can be used to either interpreted to say the EPA can do what it's doing or EPA cannot do what it's doing. I think that today's ruling, I agree with you, DR, is encouraging in the sense that at least the court looked at the intent of the law and not the specific rulings. And in all these things, there's another court case, which I guess goes by the name of Chevron, which says that when there's ambiguity in the law, this other ruling says that you have to defer to the EPA. And if the EPA presents an interpretation, that's probably the right one, and the court shouldn't get involved. And so there's lots of interesting discussion about exactly how the Supreme Court is going to rule, because you know it's going to be challenged, how the Supreme Court will rule on Obama's clean power plan. And we will look back at the Obamacare ruling to say, all right, was that a portent, or you know, what did that tell us, right?
Exactly. And how interesting is it that the ruling that is made reference to that you just noted in terms of interpretation of statutes by an agency is known as Chevron versus NRDC, and, you know, and Chevron being one of the entities that is causing the problem that the NRDC is trying to fix in this, well, there you in this go. Particular there you case.
Go. So there were two cute little things that I wanted to sort of mention. Oftentimes we wonder if solar power is going to save us, but it turns out that last year, you may remember, the Europeans sent a space probe, a mission out to a comet, and that little thing, it's called, that little device is called Philae, I think is the name of it, and it basically landed on the comet successfully, but kind of fell into a shadow and froze down to minus 180 centigrade or something. It turns out now that 8 or 9 months later, the power, as the comet has gotten closer to the sun, the whole thing has warmed up, and that device came back to life and started broadcasting signals from the comet as it's getting close to the sun. Just really, I mean, it proves you that solar power is something that we ought to take seriously, right?
Definitely, definitely.
And the other interesting one, I'll put up the link. This is a link from Grist. And you've all heard of this concept of something called biomimicry, where engineers try to look at plants and animals and build devices that are similar to the animals. Well, it turns out that everyone knows, or maybe the mice don't, but owls can fly almost silently. Right? There's no whoosh or anything, right? They just come in, they get the mouse, and they have a nice dinner. Well, it turns out when you look carefully at the owl's wings, they have this special kind of patterny stuff on the wing that the scientists can emulate. So what do? They take that special pattern that they found from the owl's wing, and they put it on wind turbines and make them significantly quieter.
Awesome.
So it's just cool. Cool stuff, right?
And
I keep saying when I see these things is that if and when the full bore ingenuity of the country is focused on clean energy, you know, presumably through a carbon price, right? When all of a sudden people start paying attention, we will be astounded at the amount of progress that can be made based on all these crazy things to have a cleaner world. I mean, I have great faith that people can invent remarkable renewable energy, clean technology.
Well, necessity is the mother of invention.
There you go. So, DR, we will put up links to most of what we talked about on the blog. It's a WordPress blog. It's massclimateaction.wordpress.com. Please leave us a comment or send us a letter to comment@massclimateaction.net. You can find us on Facebook at /MassClimateAction, where you can share us with your friends, or click through the blog and listen from Facebook. You can find us, you can listen to us directly on your smartphone using Stitcher, and of course, you can find us on the venerable iTunes, right? Just go to the podcast section and search for Massachusetts Climate Action. Please subscribe to us, rate us. It improves the visibility of the show and helps other people find us. So we will close the way we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, and because we believe it is our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the United States put a price on carbon. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you all again next week. Bye-bye.